Have you heard of the Bereans? According to the Apostle Paul, they were noble-minded because they neither accepted nor rejected his message until they had first checked it against the scriptures to see if it was really true. Welcome to Truth Matters with Sean Finnegan. Our aim here at Truth Matters is to be as the Bereans each week by interviewing guest speakers and investigating topics, testing them against the scriptures to discover truth and shed falsehood. And now, here is your host, Sean Finnegan.
Good morning and welcome to Truth Matters. I'm Sean Finnegan, and for the next half hour, I'll be speaking with Alex Hall from London, and he's going to be talking to us about how Christianity came to understand Jesus as time went on. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hi, Sean.
It's good to have you back again. Last time we talked about Christianity in the early first couple of centuries. Today we're going to be talking about how that development continued right on through the fourth century and address specifically the Council of Nicaea.
Yes, yes.
So what was the controversy brewing during this time?
Okay, I'm going to focus on the period between the Council of Nicaea in AD 325 and the Council of Constantinople in 381.
Okay.
And the big source of contention was the Arian controversy.
Okay.
Now, I probably might be useful for me to give a little bit of background into what we mean by the word Arian.
I think a lot of people are thinking blonde-haired German people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. In actual fact, in some strange way, that conception does relate to this original character of Arius.
Really?
Who in actual fact was a North African. So we're probably talking about somebody who would look very different to the stereotypical blonde-haired and blue-eyed person.
Right.
But he's a priest called Arius. He lived in Libya. He, in essence, was proclaiming that Jesus, as the Son of God, was strictly subordinate to God the Father. He was in a relationship of obedience and servanthood, really, to God the Father. And that if he did enjoy any status of equality with God, this was not something that was inherently his, but it was given to him by God as a result of promotion. So it was something that he attained.
Uh-huh. He also believed that Jesus was a created being as well.
That is the absolutely key difference.
Right.
The key issue, which you just said, kind of hinged around was there a time when the Son did not exist? That's what Arius said. He said, there's a time when the Son did not exist. The church, although it's good to describe it as a church, maybe another terminology would be useful, because it was an underground cell structure. It was a persecuted movement. And therefore, the methods they adopted in meeting and proclaiming their message and communicating with one another and recruiting people with their message will be similar to many terrorist networks today, which operate that way to not be found out.
Okay.
It wasn't this monolithic structured thing with a hierarchy and creeds and all of these sorts of things. It was a group of people gathered around a message, gathered around a group of documents, and each group was fairly autonomous and fairly free to kind of make up its own mind what it believed without any central authority checking up on them. You just couldn't do that in an underground cell structure. But after the Edict of Milan in 313, when Christianity was made legal, then what happened was these people were able to emerge into the light and begin organizing themselves.
Okay.
And that is what resulted in this initial clash. And this is really the growing pains of the monolithic hierarchical church, which sort of became birthed and then became known as the Catholic Church. They had to sort out what do we as a body believe, and what do we do with people who say that their interpretation of Christianity, of the scriptures, of who Jesus is, differs from ours.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about Constantine and his role in this whole controversy.
Yes, Constantine. If we go back to 303, you have the emperors Diocletian and Galerius instituting what's called the Great Persecution. It was the last great persecution of the church. And in 313, as I said, the joint rulers of the Roman Empire, Constantine and Licinius, published the Edict of Milan, and that said that Christianity, like the pagan religions, was free to be practiced. But it didn't specify what was meant by Christianity. That was to happen later. So anybody claiming to be any kind of Christian was more or less on an equal footing. There's no dictionary definition of this is a Christian or this is a Catholic.
Right. Okay.
Then in 316 to 324, there was a big fallout between Constantine and Licinius. Licinius launches the last burst of persecution in the east, and then eventually Constantine defeats him at the Battle of Milvian Bridge and becomes the sole emperor. And what he did then was began to set about, as with his imperial power, he was a bloody man, like most of the Roman empires, just is gangster number one. But he could see the immense power that Christianity had to bring about cohesion in the empire. He could gather people around this one religion He was looking to endorse it with the state, but first of all, he had to get what he would have seen as being these petty squabbles between Christians out of the way.
Okay.
He's the powerful guy in terms of the secular arm.
Right. He seems to be the one who was putting the pressure to work everything out in a council. But I wonder if we could just go back and talk about Arius and what happened in his region when he was teaching this doctrine about there was a time when he was not.
He was a charismatic individual, very gifted. He wrote these catchy little tunes, and through that he was able to transmit. You know, some people in those days were illiterate, probably more than today, so having something which is orally memorable was very useful. And what I'm going to do, Sean, is to really challenge one of the main myths of church history, which was that what we now call orthodoxy has always been the majority, and that the heretics came from the outside, tried to influence the majority, but were then successfully repelled, and that this great big monolithic bastion orthodoxy, which we call the church, kind of continued sailing through. In actual fact, there were vast numbers of people who saw nothing scandalous or even surprising in what Arius was teaching. They would have been considered orthodoxy by them, as well as a great number who say, no, the Son has always existed, and the Son has always been equal with the Father. Arius wasn't some radical out on the fringes. What he articulated, particularly skillfully, subsequent to which he became the spokesman for that viewpoint, that he actually had an enormous amount of people already believing what he taught, and he kind of crystallized a lot of the opinion into these expressions, which were then communicated across the Mediterranean world. For a great period of time, people who believed that Jesus, you know, existed before he was born, or people who believed that there was a time when the Son was not, would probably have met and not seen it as a particularly scandalous difference. Part of the effect of this Arian controversy was to actually drive people to two different poles and generate a great deal of hostility. We're going to see through the course of the conversation, if we have time, but it was a very bloody conflict. It included beatings, kidnappings, torture, arson, witness intimidation, poisoning, the full range, the full gamut of what we would call gangsters.
Right.
And it was done by instigators, by thugs and henchmen on both sides of the debate.
Wow.
But it meant that the simple believers in the middle could have been tempted to kind of become quite sectarian in their concept. And one of the things it did was it led to a militant spirit within the church. And we can probably see that the origins of a lot of the subsequent persecutions of Catholics, of heretics, and of Protestants by Catholics, and so on and so forth, the seeds were sown in that very early period.
Yeah. So how did it develop? What happened next?
Okay. In 318, Bishop Alexander, who was the Bishop of Alexandria, which was one of the great urban centers, center of learning, culture, and financial center in North Africa, calls a council of bishops to get everyone signed up to this confession of orthodoxy that he had drawn up in order to refute Arius. He said, it's time to unify around the truth and get these heretics out of the way. Anybody who refused to sign up to his, what he called orthodox creed, the punishment they faced would be removal from their position.
Wow.
Arius then travels up from Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey, to meet with the influential Eusebius of Nicomedia. Eusebius is a very influential church leader of the Greek-speaking eastern wing of the church. He then promptly, in 319, convenes his own council, which overturns the decision of Alexander.
Okay.
So right now it's neck and neck. You've had one council 1 year anathematizing Arius' view, and the second council a year later endorsing his view.
Okay.
In 321 to 322, another council is drawn up by a different Eusebius, Eusebius of Caesarea. He also endorses Arius and says, no, Arius is orthodox. Alexander and his creed are the ones that are heretics. Then, in 325, Hosius, he's one of Constantine's fixers. You know, these immensely powerful people have trusted guys that they can send out to get things done and, you know, bang heads together if necessary.
Right, yeah,
Hosius would have been Constantine's guy. Sends him down, and it's at that time that the Council of Antioch meets, and it comes up with what would be a proto-Trinitarian creed. Nothing like as detailed or as sophisticated as the subsequent Trinitarian formulas, but they came up with something roughly approximating a Trinitarian formula, sort of headed in that direction.
Okay.
And they anathematize, which means to curse, denounce, or excommunicate anybody who didn't sign up to it. This is followed later on in the same year with the Council of Nicaea. So we're still in 325. And the Council of Nicaea is the one where Constantine himself presided and placed as much pressure as he could on these bishops to sort themselves out.
So, as you mentioned before, Constantine's motivation is not so much that he has a love of the truth and he wants to see truth prevail, so much as he can use Christianity to unite the empire, but not if Christianity can't agree on who Christ is.
Yeah.
That's his motivation here. What happened during the Council of Nicaea?
Eusebius of Caesarea, remember he's the one that in 321 led a council which went against Alexander. He reads out a creed that would be acceptable to both Arians and anti-Arians, depending upon how you interpret it.
Okay.
Constantine then suggested the addition of homoousios. I don't think we've got time to go into the meaning of all these words, but just to say, so homoousios is a word which is found nowhere in the Bible. But Constantine insisted that this concept be used as the definition of the relationship between the Father and the Son. Really means of the same substance. They're made of the same stuff.
Okay.
So he imports a Greek word, which is very current in Greek philosophy, Greek theology, tries to cram it into the Christianity, which, although it's not found anywhere in the Bible, and says, you know, this is what you need to sign up to. The two, Arius and a couple of Libyan bishops, were the only ones that refused to sign up to it. And as a result, they were sent off into exile.
So the direct result of the Council of Nicaea was Arius and somebody else, they were forced into exile.
Yes, Arius and two of his guys.
Okay.
So what I'm going to do is give you a total of the number of councils and the number of verdicts that were reached. But at the moment, you've had three against Arius and two in favor of him.
Okay.
Now, the next council in AD 328 rules in favor of Arius. That's the Council of Nicomedia. Then in 335, the Council of Tyre also rules in favor of Arius. Bishop Alexander has died by now. Athanasius is his right-hand man. He was Bishop Alexander's fixer, in essence.
Okay.
And he then rises to the fore of the anti-Arian movement. The creed which is subsequently formulated, one of the early Trinitarian creeds, is called the Athanasian Creed after this guy. Athanasius is not a Christ-like person. I'll just have to put it to you like that. He is put on trial at the Council of Tyre in 335. The specific charges are the beating, kidnapping, torture of people who are against him, as well as burning down their churches.
Athanasius is being accused of these things?
He's been accused of these things.
And they found him guilty?
They do find him guilty, in spite of the fact that during the process of the Council of Tyre, he kidnaps and intimidates those witnesses that he can access.
Oh, wow.
So there's nothing that you wouldn't see nowadays with, you know, an organized crime syndicate.
What is this doing in the church? I mean, it's just bizarre.
It's very strange. I think it's really about power. It's really about men's lust for power and control.
Wow.
And at that time, in that particular part of the world, religion was a great influence on people's everyday lives, the same way as money would be today in a lot of our societies. If you could hold religious power, you could pull strings. And I think that's what the attraction was. I don't believe it was much to do with serving the Lord Jesus Christ, certainly not in the way that he conducts himself. And to be fair, Arius either. His followers were also guilty of unlawful deeds.
So before you get back to telling us what happened next, Alex, could you summarize just a bit about how you see these things working out up to this point?
The essence of this kind of message, really, from church history, if we study it, is that we can't really say that any one church is God's organization based upon God's guiding hand because of the creed that they formulated was somehow divinely instigated or providentially protected by God. What we see is a process which is thoroughly to do with power politics, and it's every bit the machinations of human beings. That's really the chief conclusion I would draw from a study of the facts.
Okay, and so at this council, did you say the Council of Tyre?
Council of Tyre 335, yeah.
Athanasius was found guilty. What happened then?
He presents himself to Constantine, protesting his innocence, asking for mercy, but the evidence is far too conclusive. Constantine would love, here is the person who's championing his flagship creed. If there was anything Constantine could have done to get him off the hook, he would have done so, but the evidence is just far too onerous, and so he has to banish him to a place called Trier in Gaul. It's only upon his death, really, that eventually there was a custom in Rome that when an emperor died, people could return from exile. That's really what allows Athanasius to get off the hook.
Okay.
But this period he spends on the run, he disappears off into the desert. He's got lots of colonies in the desert which are supportive of him. So being banished isn't too much of a problem. Again, like many organized crime figures, he has safe houses. He has a network of contacts, and he can disappear when he needs to.
Wow.
He's quite a character, Athanasius. He's sort of a bit of a rogue.
Yeah.
So now we have 336. There's another council held at Constantinople, not the council of Constantinople.
No, that's 381, right?
381, yeah. Correct. Yeah, that's right. But at this time, the Arian creed is upheld.
Wow.
And once again in 337, another council it is. So right now we've had nine councils. Out of those nine councils, only three of them are found against Arius. The other six are all in favor of him.
Wow.
Church history could have gone a completely different way. The Catholic Church could have actually had an Arian creed.
Wow.
And then anybody proclaiming Trinitarianism would have been the outsider, would have been the heretic, would have been the bad guy. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. What's so amazing is that in my church history book that I had when I went to Bible college, they didn't mention any of this whatsoever. They just said Constantine called for a council to unify Christianity. They drew up the Council of Nicaea, the creed that declared that Jesus was of the same substance as the Father, that they're co-equal, co-eternal, and so on, and that then the heretics were banished and we all lived happily ever after. I mean, there was no mention whatsoever of Arius having councils in his favor.
Yeah.
That's incredible that they wouldn't even mention that at all in my history book.
It's ugly, though, isn't it? It's ugly to have to look at this process and to say what happened in church history. And I think there's that tendency for us to want to look away from these things and say, no, God's hand was in it. God guided it. It's all of him. But we have to have a commitment to truth, even when the truth makes us uncomfortable, forces us to confront things which aren't palatable. We have to try and face up to the facts.
The
historical facts. So let me just finish running off the list of these councils, because there's 25 of them in total. In 337, by now Constantine has died and Athanasius has been able to return from his exile. 337, large council of bishops in Antioch. And they add another list of atrocities to the charges already levelled against Athanasius. They want the new emperor to send him off into exile. This time it's for the instigation of several murders and the misappropriation and embezzlement of charitable funds in order to finance his violent campaign. So he's subverting church funds to hire thugs to commit murder. And they're saying, this isn't right, this isn't really acceptable for a leader in the church. Let's get him deposed. And it finds once more in favor of Arius. In 338, Athanasius responds by getting his loyalists together, and they accuse the others of being haters of Christ and condemn the Arian party. In 338, the same year, the Eastern Church leaders hold another council in Antioch with a verdict against Athanasius. They uphold the condemnation of him given at the Council of Tyre that he's really a criminal. 339, March the 16th, imperial troops set out to arrest Athanasius. All hell breaks loose, and there's rioting between various mobs of henchmen and Arian thugs. And it goes on for days and days, and in the end he jumps in a boat and escapes off to Rome and manages to get the Western ruler, Constans, who inherited the western section of the Roman Empire from Constantine. And Constans kind of adopts him and begins to champion his cause. And this is where you see the bounce back, the Athanasian bounce back. Constans becomes even more powerful in 340 when Constantine II, his brother, invades his territory and ends up getting killed. So now you've got this big split. You've got two guys. Constantius is ruling in the eastern wing of the Roman Empire, and the western wing is ruled by Constans. Constans is Athanasian, and Constantius is on the Arian side.
You don't think they could have come up with more original names, huh?
Well, I just think that maybe Constantine had a bit of an ego issue. The actual three sons were called Constantine II, Constans, and Constantius, yeah.
That's terrible. Get over yourself. Goodness.
I don't think this guy had self-esteem issues at all.
No, he had a very healthy ego.
In 342... another council's convened. Pope Julius has a council of Trier and condemns the Athanasians. Then you have councils in 343 at Serdica, another one in 343 at Serdica, and in 351 at Sirmium. And these three councils are all kind of hung councils. They can't seem to swing it either way.
Okay.
So they're kind of like three in-between councils. In 353, Constantius becomes the sole emperor after defeating a rival. And what you then have is a section of councils who all find in favor of Arianism. This is really where you would have thought that orthodoxy would have been defined in Arian terms, and that would have been the end of the historical process with regards to the battle, the Arian controversy. In 353, two councils are held. In 355, another one. They're held at Arles, Béziers, and Milan, respectively. In 357, in Sirmium, an explicitly Arian creed is formulated and presented to both Eastern and Western churches as the definition of orthodoxy. In 358, there's another one at Sirmium, also Arian. And in 359, there's another one at Sirmium, also Arian. So one after the other, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 councils who all find in favor of Arianism. The other ones being in 359, the Council of Rimini Seleucia, and in 360, the Council of Constantinople. So you've had a massive run there, all of Arian councils. And then this Emperor Theodosius in 379 comes to power, and he is militant in his persecution of Arianism. He's Athanasian through and through, and he is the first person to give a law which instigates the persecution of people who do not sign up to his concept of Christianity. Previously, bishops would be removed from their position, and at worst, they would be exiled. He actually formulated in law that people should be tried and prosecuted for not having the Orthodox faith as defined in Athanasian terms.
Wow.
And in 381, two councils are held. One of them is called the Council of Constantinople, and the other one is called the Council of Aquileia. Both of them fiercely endorse Athanasianism. The only people left who are Arians are these Visigoths, Burgundians, and Vandals, these kind of groups which are migrating across from Eastern Europe and beginning to settle in the areas of Western Europe. That's the only place where you'll find significant amounts of Arians, because everywhere else they've been persecuted. They're having their goods confiscated. Their writings are being destroyed. To date, in spite of the massive volumes and volumes of books written about this person, in spite of the huge impact he's had on church history, there are no writings of Arius available. Everything we know about him has been written about him by other people.
Wow. That's just incredible.
So they were very thorough in trying to completely wipe out from the pages of history what these people actually said.
So that's the old saying, the victors write the history books.
George Orwell also made an absolutely amazing statement, which I think deserves to be really thought upon quite deeply. He said, "He who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past." If you're in charge right now, you get to rewrite the past any way you like it. And that way you program people to kind of follow your agenda for the future, I suppose.
Well, thankfully we're in an age and a time when things are different, and we have the internet, we have access to public libraries, we have so much information right at our fingertips where we can look up these different things. And thankfully, the discipline of archaeology didn't develop until the last few hundred years, because if it had developed earlier, they would have found old things and just burned them if they disagree with them.
That's a good point, Sean.
Maybe God's doing something in our own age where now truth is being revealed, is being made available in a much more widespread way, so that people can see the facts. You know, that's all I want as a truth seeker. And, you know, what this show stands for is, let's not be afraid of the truth. Let's embrace it. If it hurts, I don't care. I still want it. Let's just follow it wherever it leads, because I just don't think it's a good thing to be afraid of the truth. And if the truth is that the church mutated with time and got corrupted, I don't need to get all hung up and say, well, God would never let that happen or whatever. I could just say, okay, those are the facts. What can I do now to recover the truth and to share it with others? There's a lot of lessons here for us to learn. What would you offer in the way of concluding remarks?
Well, maybe we could just do what they do at the end of a ball game, which is kind of look at the stats.
Yeah, let's tally up the stats.
See how the figures add up. If we look at the church councils and we add them up, we found that 15 of those councils found in favor of the Arian creed. Only 7 of them found in favor of the Nicene creed, and 3 of them ended in stalemate. So in actual fact, more than twice as many church councils convened within the church, which was inclusive of everyone and trying to define itself and find out what orthodoxy was, more than twice as many concluded in favor of Arianism than concluded against it.
Wow.
It just blows apart this idea of a uniform, monolithic organization with a set of creeds handed down from the apostles fighting off heretics from the outside. The church went through a huge identity crisis, which could have gone either way, but it just so happens it went in an Athanasian direction.
Right, which is also the same as what we would call the Trinity today.
It defines the Trinity, yeah.
Right.
Ask for the Orthodox definition of the Trinity, what you have will be the words of the Athanasian Creed.
Wow.
My personal conclusion from all of this, Sean, which I'd like to press upon anyone who's hearing these words, would be if these creeds are the product of history, we need to go back to the Bible to see whether they match up with the Bible. Because Jesus said, by their fruits you'll know them. Both Arius and Athanasius were involved in violence and all kinds of wrong things. I don't want to have my interpretation of the Bible predicated by such people. I want to go back to the Bible and weigh up the creeds against the scriptures to see if I filter it through the scripture, what do I get?
Absolutely.
We cannot trust in organizations with so much blood on their hands. Hmm. If what they say matches the Bible at any point, then good. But let's not assume it does just because they've got lots of numbers or they've got a history that goes back a long way.
Right. Well, thanks so much for sharing that saga of church history.
It's been a pleasure, Sean.
Wish we had more time to get into more detail
on
each of those councils to find out more information about them and to really get into this a little deeper. But the show is only a half an hour, so we're limited by that. But thanks for the research that you did looking at When Jesus Became God by Richard Rubinstein and the other sources for your talk here. I appreciate you spending the time to investigate this stuff.
Thanks for hearing me, Sean. It's been fantastic speaking to you.
Thank you for listening to Truth Matters with Pastor Sean Finnegan, where pursuing truth is more important than preserving tradition. If you'd like to access our archive of previous shows or leave us feedback, including suggestions for future shows, log on to truthmattersradio.com or give us a call at 518-785-8888.